Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Bringing together some 115 photographs from across four decades of the artist's career, Sally Mann, A Thousand Crossings, offers both a sweeping overview of her achievement and a focused exploration of the continuing influence of the American South on her work. For a public symposium held on April 14, 2018, in conjunction with the exhibition, Sean Michelle Smith examines the role of photography as a tool of self-construction for African Americans after slavery. Smith discusses the numerous photographic portraits of abolitionist Frederick Douglass, as well as his early lectures on photography in the 1860s, presenting his thoughts on the medium as a novel theory of it as well as a new model of personhood. This program is made possible by the James D. and Catherine K. Steele Fund for Photography.
On December 3, 1861, Frederick Douglass, the famous abolitionist, gave a lecture titled Pictures and Progress at the Tremont Temple in Boston. The lecture was nearly a total failure. Everyone expected Douglass to give a rousing speech about slavery and abolition. Instead, on that winter evening, he spoke about the revolutionary power of photography. Although his ideas about the medium were not well received at the time, Douglass was one of the earliest and most innovative theorists of photography. For him, the technology not only offered a new means of representation, but also inspired a new understanding of self. Looking back to Douglass's lectures on photography today, one discovers in them a sophisticated theory of the medium, as well as an emergent model of personhood. When Douglass began to write his philosophy of photography in 1861, he had already embraced the technology as a means of self-representation. Indeed, as John Stoffer, Zoe Trod, and Celeste Marie Bernier have demonstrated, Douglass was the most photographed American of the 19th century. One of the most striking images of Douglass is Samuel J. Miller's portrait made in Akron, Ohio, at some point between 1847 and 1852. This daguerreotype was created at a moment of tremendous transition in Douglass's life, just after his legal emancipation had been purchased and during the years of his break with white abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison. One can imagine then that Douglass crafted his portrait to convey his new independence and his new status as citizen subject. How did Douglass greet the camera to represent such momentous transformation? Finely dressed and carefully coiffed, according to the conventions of middle-class portraiture. But beyond such trappings, the image does not adhere to middle-class standards. It does not mimic the space of the parlor, as do so many 19th-century photographs. Instead, Douglass sits at an angle to the camera, tightly framed and isolated in the image. The camera has come in close to focus on his head, shoulders, and chest, accentuating his face and solemn stare. As Bernier has proposed, his daguerreotype adheres very closely to the conventions of heroic portraiture. In Alan Trachtenberg's memorable words, Douglass is photographed as an illustrious American. Douglass's portrait announces his self-possession, but it remains shadowed by the contradictions of slavery. For Douglass's freedom was purchased according to the dictates of slavery. In 1846, supporters in England paid for his emancipation, an act that pretended to secure his safety, even as it also reinforced the logic of slavery whereby subjects could be bought and sold as objects. As Douglass outlines in his 1845 narrative, he had already emancipated himself through his learning, his fight with his purported master Covey, and his escape. But his self-emancipation was not and would not be recognized by all. While slavery endured, legal freedom had to be secured according to the terms of the institution through purchase. Douglass acquiesced so that he might continue his work of abolition without the constant threat of capture. Therefore, his portrait in freedom is perplexing, as it represents a legal freedom defined both against and according to the terms of the institution from which he escaped. As a man someone once and recently claimed to own, as a man someone once and recently claimed to own, could Douglass be confirmed in his self-possession? Would he ever be truly free while slavery persisted? Would anyone? And what about the afterlife of slavery in a post-emancipation period? If the law could accommodate people alienated as property, wasn't the self-possession of all subjects put under pressure? In Miller's daguerreotype, Douglass asserts a self-possession he knows to be precarious. As Ginger Hill has argued, for Douglass, the portrait becomes, quote, a way to accumulate characteristics of self-possession. It does not reflect, but makes a self, end quote. The daguerreotype becomes a vehicle through which one can display the habitual self-containment and control central to self-possession. As slavery unhinged the idea that self-possession was innate, racial discourses intervene to shore up self-possession as a category for whites only. As Matthew Fry Jacobson has argued, self-possession was a racially contested status in the 19th century. American citizens were presumed to have self-possession, quote, a condition already denied legally to Africans in slavery and figuratively to all non-white or so-called heathen peoples in prevailing conceptions of human capacity, end quote. If enslaved Africans were denied self-possession, what of fugitive slaves and free African Americans? Could they claim to be self-possessed citizens in the United States? Douglass understood that legal emancipation was insufficient. He also had to secure his image as a free man, and he did so through repeated photographic performances. According to Hill, quote, the circulation of these pictures helped create and guarantee his citizen status, visually proclaiming Douglass's natural right to own property and thus be seen as equal, which is to say autonomous and free. Both the attention to detail within each act of self-presentation and the repetition of that act foreground Douglass's precarious claim to the social status of equality, and also the fact that he understood such states of possession and recognition as systems of accumulation, end quote. So the repetition of Douglass's performance for the camera asserts his self-possession. Although optimistic about the promise of photography, Douglass was also highly attuned to the importance of the struggle over representation. He knew that photographs circulated in a contested visual culture. Describing it as a mighty power, Douglass proclaimed, quote, this picture-making faculty is flung out into the world like all others, subject to a wild scramble between contending interests and forces, end quote. He understood, as Sarah Blackwood has argued, that, quote, the visual portrait was an active site upon which the fight for African-American political representation was taking place, end quote. As the medium offered men and women an unprecedented opportunity for self-representation, it offered African-American men and women that opportunity as they were making claims on new legal, political, and socially recognized American identities in flux. Douglass sought to challenge racist representations that cast African-Americans as less than human. As early as 1849, he decried the difficulty of securing realistic portraits of African Americans at the hands of white artists. He declared in the North Star, quote, it seems to us next to impossible for white men to take likenesses of black men without most grossly exaggerating their distinctive features, end quote. In this contested cultural context, photography might serve as a political tool to challenge racist hierarchies, but it would not do so automatically. One would have to use the technology, as Douglass did, to perform subjectivity and claim a place in public and political spheres. When Douglass began to lecture on photography, the new imaging technology was roughly 20 years old. As Miller's portrait of the orator makes clear, he was well acquainted with one of its earliest forms, the daguerreotype. By 1861, a new kind of image, the carte de visite, had recently been invented, and it greatly increased the availability of the photograph. Whereas the daguerreotype was a single positive image object, this new form of photography created a negative from which any number of positive prints could be reproduced. The new technology was fast and inexpensive, and at the time of Douglas's lecture, photography could be said to be in the hands of almost everyone. Curiously, in proclaiming his enthusiasm for photography in 1861, Douglas returns to the earlier technology, the daguerreotype. He's interested in the advent of the medium as much as its contemporary manifestations, because he sees in photography a new means of representation and even the dawn of a new era. To capture the potential of a radical new beginning, he returns to the narrative of photography's invention. In Pictures in Progress, he praises Louis Daguerre, whom he calls the great father of our modern picture, for the multitude, variety, perfection, and cheapness of his pictures. Douglas proclaims, quote, "Daguerre, by simple but all-abounding sunlight, has converted the planet into a picture gallery. Daguerreotypes, ambrotypes, photographs, and electrotypes, good and bad, now adorn or disfigure all our dwellings. Men of all conditions may see themselves as others see them. What was once the exclusive luxury of the rich and great is now within reach of all," end quote. Douglas emphasizes photography's democratizing powers, celebrating the accessibility of the medium for ordinary people. He declares, quote, "The humblest servant girl may now possess a picture of herself such as the wealth of kings could not purchase 50 years ago," end quote. Leveling the social hierarchies of portraiture, photography offered a seemingly revolutionary and universal tool of self-representation. The daguerreotype appealed to Douglas for a number of reasons, and the material qualities of the image may have been particularly meaningful to him. As many scholars have noted, the viewer of the daguerreotype sees herself reflected in the mirror-like image. In this way, the daguerreotype seems to unite viewer and viewed in the same space of reflection, inviting and even requiring the viewer to see herself in relation to the photographed subject. The daguerreotype image is also unusual in that it flickers between negative and positive as it is held and tilted. Some scholars surmise that the seeming instability of the image may have appealed to Douglas and served his purpose as well. As the genre of photography most fleeting and fragile, even as it is also solidly material, the daguerreotype provided an appropriate medium for representing a fugitive freedom. As Bernier notes, quote, "Just as Douglas was a fugitive slave, so too did the daguerreotype record a fugitive image, as elusive and ephemeral as it was palpable and real," end quote. Indeed, according to Bernier, Douglas aimed to counter a history of slave portraiture with fugitive portraiture, which represented the ways in which, quote, "slavery and freedom remained relative physical and psychological states of existence," end quote. The daguerreotype offered Douglas a unique emblem of both photographic fixity and fugitivity, and in this way it provided a compelling representation of slavery's contradictions. The analogy between fleeting image and fugitive slave is more fundamental than one might suppose. Indeed, in differing ways, both troubled the distinctions between persons and property. The fugitive is, as Stephen Best explains, quote, "two persons in one, pilfered property and indebted person, object of property and subject of contract," end quote. The fugitive slave who is forced to steal himself is categorically defined as both subject and object, as both person and property. According to Cheryl Harris, there was always, quote, "some unease in slave law, reflective of the mixed status of slaves as humans and property. But the critical nature of social relations under slavery was the commodification of human beings. Slavery as a legal institution treated slaves as property that could be transferred, assigned, inherited, or posted as collateral," end quote. Photography enacted another kind of blurring of the distinctions between persons and property in the 19th century. As Best has argued, the introduction of mechanically reproductive devices, such as the camera, encouraged people, quote, to secure property rights in heretofore inalienable aspects of their personhood, their visual image, ideas, facial expressions, and even vocal style, end quote. In other words, after the advent of mechanical reproduction, labor was no longer the only alienable property right. Increasingly, one could claim intellectual property rights in one's countenance. Remarkably, the problem of the fugitive as both subject and object parallels the changing definitions of legal personhood introduced by photography, namely the alienation of oneself as image. Douglas, once a fugitive slave himself, seized on photography's alienation of the subject and saw its capacities for objectification as crucial to its social power. He celebrated photography as a new form of picture making, and one cannot overstate the importance Douglas accorded pictures. He argued that it was the picture making faculty that fundamentally determined what it meant to be human. Picture making and picture appreciating distinguished men from animals. Quote, "The process by which man is able to invert his own subjective consciousness into the objective form, considered in all its range, is in truth the highest attribute of man's nature," end quote. A person's ability to objectify herself becomes for Douglas the essence of being human. Photography realizes a defining feature of humanity, and one that is surprisingly resonant with the status of the fugitive slave. In photography, then, Douglas finds an analogy to his own confounding legal status, when he deems the very indicator of the human. Picture making serves for Douglas as a means of declaring self-possession. It also serves as an impetus for progress. Picture making and viewing provide a catalyst for social change because these practices uniquely encourage criticism. According to Douglas, quote, "It is the picture of life contrasted with the fact of life, the ideal contrasted with the real, which makes criticism possible. Where there is no criticism, there is no progress, for the want of progress is not felt where such want is not made visible by criticism," end quote. By making themselves objects of observation and contemplation, people can begin to imagine better selves and better futures. For Douglas, portraits invite individuals to, quote, "see our interior selves as distinct personalities, as though looking in a glass," end quote. Further, according to Douglas, quote, "from this power we possess of making ourselves objective to ourselves, arises the potential for self-criticism out of which comes the highest attainments of human excellence," end quote. Pictures allow people to see themselves as if from the outside, and from this more distanced view, to contemplate and assess themselves. Encouraging self-critique in this way, pictures are the very foundation of progress, and photographic portraits can inspire social change. To transform subjective consciousness into the objective form is a process of alienation, the very form of alienation sanctioned by intellectual property law. The objectification of one's image in a photograph allowed one to claim property rights in that image, to own an aspect of oneself as property. In a much more fundamental way, the fugitive slave who stole himself as object was subject to and resisted a radical, violent alienation. Both forms of alienation troubled the boundaries of legal personhood, although of course they did so to dramatically different degrees. Nevertheless, it's somewhat curious that Douglas, once a fugitive slave, would embrace photography so enthusiastically and perform the objectification of himself so extensively. Through photography, Douglas realized a new model of personhood, a model in which the subject could be alienated as property, but through that objectification could also claim a new kind of self-ownership, and ultimately a new form of self-understanding. For Douglas, the path to personal growth is through the critical contemplation of oneself as object, and photography provides all subjects an opportunity for improvement through objectification. Douglas is not alone in sensing the power of objectification through photography. What is unique about his view is that he understands such objectification as the defining feature of humanity and also as the path to progress. Writing more than a century later, Roland Barthes also understood photography as a process of objectification. As he contemplated his own displeasure in being photographed, he mused, quote, "The photograph, the one I intend, represents that very subtle moment when, to tell the truth, I'm neither subject nor object, but a subject who feels he is becoming an object," end quote. Resisting objectification, Barthes proclaims, quote, "It is my political right to be a subject which I must protect," end quote. The very habit of composing oneself for the camera, of crafting one's image, was for Barthes a sundering of the self. The process through which Douglas proclaimed himself as subject was one in which Barthes only had political rights to lose. As Laura Wexler has argued, quote, "Barthes experienced submission to photography in much the same way that Frederick Douglass experienced submission to slavery, as social death. But Barthes starts out alive and then dies into his picture, whereas the slave starts out as a social corpse and is animated through the photograph," end quote. It's important not to overstate the analogy between slavery and photography, for clearly the dehumanization and devastation of slavery in no way compares to Barthes' discomfort before the camera. Nevertheless, it's also important to recognize that for both Douglas and Barthes, photography activates a new way of objectifying the subject. It asks one to see oneself as an object, as others might. For Barthes, this marks the end of his sovereign subjectivity. But for Douglas, it enables him to claim self-possession. Douglas delivered his lecture, Pictures and Progress, one final time in 1865. In the later version, he acknowledged the seeming transgression of his desire to lecture on photography in light of the Civil War. But he persisted with his topic because he believed, quote, "Each new period and each new condition seeks its needed and appropriate representation," end quote. For Douglas, photography would provide an appropriate representation for the dynamic new period ahead. The new era would be one of freedom, a status that Douglas struggled to represent. According to Stauffer, Douglas intuited that words could not represent the sensation of freedom. In 1862, just as the Emancipation Proclamation was about to go into effect, as a new age of legal freedom was at hand, quote, "Douglas had doubts about prose being the appropriate form to describe the dawn of this new age," end quote. He sensed that prose would fail to capture the radical revolution of freedom because, as Stauffer suggests, quote, "a sharp break in linear chronology could not effectively be conveyed in prose," end quote. But such a break could be represented in photography, and for Douglas, the age of freedom would also be the age of pictures. Photography exemplifies a break in linear time. It captures, as Ulrich Baer has argued, the radical non-linearity of time, rupturing narratives of historical progression. It brings the past and also the future into the present. This temporal disruption is the contingency of photography that Walter Benjamin described in the 1930s, the radical spark of futurity that reaches across time to claim its viewer. According to Benjamin, quote, "No matter how artful the photographer, no matter how carefully posed his subject, the beholder feels an irresistible urge to search such a picture for the tiny spark of contingency, of the here and now, with which reality has, so to speak, seared the subject, to find the inconspicuous spot where in the immediacy of that long-forgotten moment, the future nests so eloquently that we, looking back, may rediscover it," end quote. Photography anticipates a future viewer as it preserves a moment from the past. In ending, I'd like to return to Miller's famous daguerreotype of Douglas. In that image, one might glimpse a spark of the profound social shifts Douglas anticipated with the end of slavery and the proliferation of photography. His portrait, circa 1847 to 52, registers an important moment in Douglas's self-understanding, for it marks a moment in which he could legally claim self-ownership and chose to announce that new status through the objectification of the photograph. The transformation of subject into object is embodied by the once fugitive slave who fashioned himself photographically. Douglas saw in the objectification of the photograph an opportunity for a new kind of self-understanding, one founded in self-observation and self-possession. Finally, then, one might see flickering in the unstable daguerreotype not only a new form of representation, but also a new form of personhood. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.